Unmistakable Led Zeppelin's Kashmir. Why? We'll find out in a sec. But before we go to Kashmir, I want to take you to Dante's Seventh Circle of Hell. Now, that's a place guarded by the Minotaur, snarling in fury, a place encircled within a river of boiling blood. The Seventh Circle is also the title of Robert Langdon's book. It's a book that details extraordinary trials and tribulations and their conquest. Now, Rob spent 7 years in Afghanistan's grimly notorious Polishaki prison, and he lived to write this tale. Rob, welcome.
How you doing?
Before we get to Afghanistan, we want to go back to Townsville. And Led Zeppelin, where do those things come together?
Yeah, I was posted to the 1st Battalion Royal Australian Regiment for a long time in Townsville, and it's always had the reputation of being a little bit different to the rest of the infantry units. They're very, very tight. It's been called the Blue Mafia because most people who've gone through there have gone on to do bigger and better things in the army have had spent time in that unit.
The Blue Mafia? That's...
Yeah. we sort of look out for each other. It's a bit...
Okay. It's a pretty tight group of men.
Yeah.
And you were 15 years in the army.
Close to, yeah. I mixed it by about a week or 2 weeks or something.
Did your army service take you to Afghanistan or...
No, it didn't.
Subsequent?
No. That was afterwards after I started in the security industry.
So tell us about that because, well, there was... It didn't end well.
No, it didn't. Well... I'm sitting here talking to you, so...
That's a positive outcome.
I spent a bit of time in Iraq first up, and a lot of years over there actually working on different jobs for the same company. And just for a bit of a change of pace, I went out to Afghanistan, hooked up with an American company out there. The whole situation in Afghanistan was run a lot looser because it was interesting because there's far more attention on Iraq, and... From my perspective, the security perspective, it was ran a lot better. I think because of the amount of media attention, Afghanistan sort of went, okay, yeah, it was finished there, now let's go to Iran. And Afghanistan, on the other hand, was the Wild West. There was absolutely no control. It's rife with corruption, even through the licensing process for the companies and working over there. And that you're basically painted into a corner to do things illegally because... They won't let you do it any other way. If you want stuff done, you have to pay someone to do it.
And then one night, you shot a guy.
Yeah, well, I'd actually left the company at that point because I just had enough of all the underhanded stuff going on just to get any normal things done, you know, and it was just getting too much. And I left. And the next day, I get a phone call, it was in the evening. I got a phone call for one of the Americans saying they'd been in a contact in Kabul. Now, this is 2009, so nowadays it's not so much a bigger deal because stuff happens in Kabul all the time now. But back then...
Things were quieter.
Yeah, the Taliban never come into town. They stuck to where they were safe. And because at that point, President Obama had initiated the surge and was basically put a heap of guys on the deck aggressively patrolling and basically push everybody back. And that was great, but he should have kept it on because as soon as they all left, they just come back in again. But anyway, that's a whole other thing. So when I went out and had a look that night, I just jumped in there. I went back to the compound because I was essentially had to pack all my stuff up anyway. And I grabbed a vehicle and a couple of guys and we went straight out there and had a look. And where it was, they'd essentially fired a rocket-propelled grenade over the top of a police checkpoint. Now, Afghani police aren't the bravest of souls. And they weren't particularly worried that this thing had gone off just near them. And I'm like, okay, this is a bit weird. And it's a sure sign that something was going down with the security team that was actually on the convoy. Because there was another Afghani trick that happens quite a bit, where if there's expats on a convoy, if they get attacked, it's usually by your own guys. And they say, no, it's too dangerous, you Westerners. Off you go back to the safe areas and we'll take care of it. Which they basically... got a license then to smuggle whatever they want on that particular convoy, because essentially it's military.
Right.
Because the way the American set it up. And just to go back on that, the way they ran the contracting is they wanted to give jobs back to the Afghan people and get a bit of money in the system. So for stuff that normally the military would do, like moving water, vehicles, stores, food, you name it, they basically contract out to the or local trucking company. So, of course, there's all of a sudden all these trucking companies sprung up out of nowhere. The guys take the load. They got their paperwork. They put them in a cooling off area for 24 hours. Then they take their paperwork inside, dump the load, get paid. So it, in theory, it's a great idea, but it's just so ripe for corruption. It's not even funny. And we were contracted to provide security for those guys. Now, so I headed out there, and the two young American guys there are going, well, this is a bit weird. This guy, he's working for the company, he's not letting them go forward, and he's at night. And my whole thing was, when I was there, I actually brought it in, was to move as much as not at night as possible, because it's safer. And this guy's not playing the game, and anyone who wants to talk to him gets a gun shoved in their face. So I'm sitting in the vehicle, and I sent one of the interpreters over there to tell him, okay, well, this is the deal. We're moving now because it's still dark, so we can at least get on the road and through the bad areas before it gets light. And I'm watching the entire exchange through night vision goggles, so there was, so I could see pretty much everything that was going on. And again, out comes the pistol. Well, he's waving in this guy's face, and he comes back and goes, yeah, nah, he's not going to do it. So that happened three times. On the third time, I was like, righto, that's it. I went over there to give him a bit of a touch-up and got the same thing. And there's a problem with people who think having a gun gives you the license to stand lorded over people and everyone's going to be scared. The trouble is, when you come across Western guys who have spent their entire lives training to do that sort of thing, the reaction is usually lethal. And, he got shot four times because of it. You know, and that was how it went.
And you, well, there's an involved and intricate story, and the story is in Robert Langdon's book. It's called The Seventh Circle, and we're tracing through it and taking Rob back to Afghanistan where these things happened. It you almost got out of the country, but didn't. You ended up 7 years in prison, a prison that, in a way, you really didn't have a right to survive that experience.
Yeah, no, it's looking back on it, I sort of shake my head sometimes, especially the early days.
How did
days.
That happen?
Yeah, well, actually a mixture of things. A lot of it, a part of it was the support of my family, especially my little sister and my girlfriend at the time. I mean, they tried their best to keep me sane. And
so you had some contact with the outside world.
Yeah, well, my girlfriend, she came over there twice. Okay. She's South African, so she's not really worried about countries that are a bit dodgy. So, yeah, she came out and seen me twice. And of course, the Blue Mafia, who were working in town, they also kept tabs on me and where I was, and that helped a lot. And I ended up in one of the sections that was essentially all African drug smugglers. And two of them were professional smugglers. The rest were doing it for varying reasons. And it was pretty interesting to see that part of the world as well, just seeing how things are done.
Describe the place. I mean, what's your cell like in that prison?
Well, that particular part, that was all just one big open area, which was not too bad. And we'd managed to...
All in together?
Yeah, pretty much. And we'd built like little tents out of blankets and stuff, which is good in the winter because there was no windows, of course, no glass in the windows, just bars. And we got left alone, essentially, left to our own devices. They come and open the door for a couple of hours a day and drop food off around the same time. But at night, it was when it was locked up, the police are too scared to go in there. So we just sort of kept to ourselves.
If the police are too scared,
yeah,
how were you feeling?
I was actually okay because, you know, I was with a large group of big black guys and we sort of looked after each other. But I won't lie to you, I mean, what kept me going there for a long time when I was by myself, I was just angry, and that helps. But you got to push it in a direction to sort of... So you can't walk out there each day and smack the nearest guy because he because you don't like him, you've got to be nice to him. And you sort of, it becomes a game. You're like, okay, I'm going to show you that I'm better than you. And you start doing that. And then after a while, the anger sort of starts to go away.
You're there in prison. You're angry because you're falsely convicted for, you know, kill a man in self-defense.
And yeah, but that's just part and parcel.
That's just the way it rolls.
Yeah. I mean, there was a South African whose case was essentially the same as mine, and he still did time. And they said, okay, that's self-defense, but you're still going to do some time.
Did you think he'd get out?
Early on, no. And there was days that I didn't think, days that I didn't think I would get through it. And you sort of have a bit of a moment, and then the next day you go, right, let's crack on again.
And were you conscious that what you had to do was work out a way to survive, that you had to you get that sorted?
Yeah, and again, that came back to just being angry, and it's like, right, it's being sorry for yourself is pointless. The one thing the military does teach you is the benefit of routines. And I sort of wondered about this a long time ago, and when I was posted to the Jungle Warfare Centre in Tully, it's in far north Queensland. And this is back in the 90s, there was still a lot of old Vietnam veterans working there. And one of them was, he was a warrant officer at the time, but he was telling us he fought the Battle of Coral, which was a pretty big deal. And he was telling us that after the first day, and everyone's sort of sitting around like zombies in the morning going, ugh. And the company sergeant major and the platoon sergeants are coming around, giving everybody a kick and going, right, get a brew on, clean your weapons, right. And straight away, okay, I've got this to do. I've got to clean my boots. I've got to do this. I've got to do this.
Suddenly life makes
sense. And
you
snap out of it, yeah. And you have something to do. So essentially I did that. I made myself a routine, which I followed to the letter, and next minute you know, a month has gone past, a year's gone past. It just rolls away. And
suddenly 7 years have gone past, and then we have Robert Langdon back amongst us, and with a book to his name as well. Mm. Rob, an extraordinary tale, and thanks for sharing with us this morning.
That's all right. Thank you very much.
The Seventh Circle is the title of Robert Langdon's book, and it tells that amazing tale of imprisonment in Afghanistan, the 7 years he spent, but got home too. Yes, write that story. Blueprint for Living here on RN.